top of the news this evening is speculation concerning the real facts behind the Department of Health announcement about a radioactive spill supposed to have occurred yesterday at the state nuclear plant.
You will die only to live again in a younger body. Then you can tell me if the operation was a success. I could easily kill you now, but I'm determined to have your brain.
You're listening to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of genre cinema. Hi, my name is Chris, and along with Jeff, we talk about movies that aren't really awful at all. Horror, action, kung fu, musicals, post-apocalyptic, women in prison films, and much, much more.
From our downtown Toronto headquarters, here's episode 375 of the Really Awful Movies Podcast. Not going to bury the lead here. I come not to praise Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but to bury it. This thing stinks. I mean, we are plummeting new depths worthy of Mariana's Trench here. Just when you thought you couldn't sink any lower, well, get your pickaxe, get your hard hat, and let's go spelunking, shall we? Because this thing is a steaming hot turd of a film. I don't even know where to begin. This just came out and has been making the rounds on social. Of course, it's been plagued by delays and looks to be rewrites, and been beset by firings and different, I guess, directors helming the project. Now, assuredly, you can temper your expectations, as the Texas Chainsaw Massacre sequel has been messed with so much and been tinkered with that nary a smidgen of its original kernel of influence remains. It's been stripped bare. It has completely been gutted. It's like a demolition team has laid a wrecking ball to it. It is in shambles. It's in pieces. Apparently there are 9 films. I gotta admit that I'm not a big supporter of Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, although I really like the audacious performance by Bill Moseley. And Dennis Hopper is really over the top. At least with that one, it went down swinging with something that they just went for the gusto, and I think it was a swing and a miss, but I can't help but appreciate the fact that at least it had the balls to believe in itself for the attempt that they were making to rejuvenate the franchise. This thing bears little to no resemblance whatsoever to any of the predecessors, other than, of course, having a wholly unoriginal name. I mean, this is the third film out of 9 that has Texas Chainsaw Massacre in it, I believe. The middle one from 2004, whenever that was, had The Excised. It's much in the same way that Evil Dead did with Fede Alvarez. And we'll come to meet him here because he's the brainchild, if you want to call it that, for lack of a better term, for putting this piece of detritus together. So 3 films of the exact same name, and this is actually par for the course when you have these reboots, when you want to really get bums in seats and you don't want to have anyone mistaking what your property is and what this franchise is. And make no mistake, it bears all the hallmarks of the term franchise and all that entails. It's like a KFC or a Taco Bell or a Pizza Hut. It's a franchise. This is it doesn't even have the good graces to be a good popcorn movie. It doesn't even entertain at that base level. And speaking of base levels, I think speaking of Mr. Alvarez, who is also responsible for Evil Dead, which is thoroughly underwhelming as well, but I think at least met the benchmark for the minimum that you would want in a horror reboot. I mean, Evil Dead, say what you will, for starters, the first 2 Evil Dead were such mind-blowing, epic films that really took horror and took it completely in a whole new direction in the midst of the slasher boom, just reinventing it, and it's been wholly imitated and widely duplicated with a little success. But at least with that one, even though it was absent the guerrilla style filmmaking and the humor of the original, it was a competently made film with quality acting, and it actually at times made you forget that you were watching a movie. The same could not be said resolutely and emphatically, point exclamation mark, about the Netflix Chainsaw Massacre film. This one, you never ever feel like you're not watching a movie. And it starts right off the bat with scene setting. We've talked repeatedly, I feel like I'm concern trolling the horror community here, as we talk repeatedly about atmosphere, and in some cases a good atmosphere can basically carry the whole day and the whole shebang and the whole freight, and you don't even need particularly good performances. If you have a milieu that you can be invested in and takes you to a different place and a different time, even something like a Burnt Offerings, which is a kind of a second tier version of The Shining, even that you have, it's imbued with a certain sense of place. It is filled with a certain something that you can at least put your finger on. It comes cohesive with a certain look and feel. You can't help coming away with this film that it is a studio backlot. This is a cheap set. It is absolutely cheap. It's almost like Warner Brothers and like the Gilmore Girls, and you could see them walking by this, or like maybe Seinfeld, where they're trying to pass the bricks that don't even look like brick. That just, this is a Potemkin village. It's the worst possible locale to shoot a film that's called Texas Chainsaw Massacre. What's the emphasis there? Texas. Shoot the film in Texas, for God's sakes. Like, that's the least you can do if that's what you're gonna call the film, and you're trying to honor this iconic property. I mean, thankfully neither Gunnar Hansen nor Marilyn Burns are here to witness this. In a way, this is just a travesty written large over this property. It's just been just busted into smithereens. This is such an insult. But so right off the bat, you have this setting that is so fake, so ridiculous, and so thoroughly lacking and totally empty and devoid of atmosphere. You have a set that looks like studio backlot versions of some studio Western made in the 50s, like some low-budget, schlocky thing. It takes you out in the movie and immediately, right off the bat, and you don't even get a chance to be introduced to anything. Now, a little bit about the plot, too, because, I mean, the plot sickens here. This is inexplicable and bereft of any kind of imagination or creativity. It is just, there's a total and whole dearth and absence of creativity here. You are meant to believe that a bunch of young 20-somethings are coming to rescue a town, and this town is in need of rescue, not because there's been sort of a major act of God that's stricken it or taken it down, but it's actually an abandoned town. So that's the conceit, okay? This Potemkin village is supposed to be abandoned, and these would-be erstwhile venture capitalists are moving in to invest their whatever silly Gen Z businesses they're going to do, like some artisanal sandwich or something, a place, some sort of upper crust tea shop or something to that effect. And they're supposed to reinvigorate this town by not moving in and gentrifying it, but actually holding a public auction for it. And which begs the question, how or why do you need to auction off buildings that are abandoned? Is this a thing? Like, are there deed or title holders that are still clinging to these properties and need, like, short of bringing in a bulldozer and just leveling the place and raising the whole thing? I mean, this is ridiculous. And a bunch of investors come in on a party bus. Not exactly Silicon Valley here, right? You have a bunch of 20-somethings on a party bus coming in to buy bits of this, like estate or estate sale or auction, or like it's some sort of police auction of just shit. This is a town, a whole town, we remind you, okay? What 20-plus year-old person has the funds, the requisite funds, to invest in real estate to this extent? Did you have the requisite funds when you were 21 or when you were struggling through college? This is such a dumb, moronic, sophomoric, mind-numbingly infantile setup and scenario that my mind is completely blown that this is actually a thing. But there you go. And if that wasn't the worst, and no, it isn't. What you get is a few nods to the au courant du jour goings-on in the zeitgeist. So you have characters scrolling through their phones, hands up, don't shoot, and allusions to Black Lives Matter and gun control. Why? I couldn't tell you, if not possibly to make potentially woke characters, SJWs, thoroughly unsympathetic so that you're wishing they would all get murdered. Well, I hate to break it to you, but Eli Roth already beat you to the punch with the superior Green Inferno, and I never thought I'd say that because that by no means is a masterpiece, but at the very least, God, Eli Roth has respect enough for the genre, particularly the Ruggiero Deodato films and the like, and the Cannibal Ferox's and that, to at least put his own imprimatur on it, to at least be something that can be held in the same, or mentioned in the same casual breath as those original Italian cannibal movies. This one resolutely cannot. Oh my God. So you have a bunch of investors in this town and a bunch of this social media, slacktivism coming to the forefront, and you have a main character who's black and is looking to buy parts of this town and comes to encounter a hillbilly chewing on a toothpick who's good with his hands and has a scowl and has a Confederate flag hanging from one of the rafters, and it's like, of course, okay, we get it. This has the level of subtlety of a monster truck rally, okay? This does nobody any favors, whether you're on the left or the right politically. These wokelings are treated like complete imbeciles, and the good with his hands, God-fearing right-wing guy, they at least try and make him cast against type, because you think, okay, this guy's going to be some hick, but at least he appears somewhat sympathetic, so why not make everyone sympathetic and don't just play your cards by the same old hand that we always get in these types of films. I mean, the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre perfectly melded, in my estimation, folk horror with exploitation, but you're invested in the proceedings because even the Texans at the heart of this, the group of five friends who gets lost and crosses paths with the Sawyer family, they are fellow residents of Texas, and they know that they're run off the beaten path. At least that film has the guts to own its subtext. You got stuff like the undercurrent and the subtext of vegetarianism, and of course the slaughterhouse, and a line of business that really is going the way of the dodo, if Beyond Meat and these types of brands will have you believe that in 20, 30 years hence, people will be looking back at this time going, what was it about people who were eating steak at every dinner when we're especially Gen Z and Gen Y and millennials and whatnot are making commitments to eating a healthier lifestyle. But that being said, you could also take it as a subtext of the American dream not being equally distributed, because you've got the Sawyer family in this business that's failing, and the economy of this part of Texas has been so hard hit. Now, it's funny that they do make an allusion to that, because when the investors, if you even want to call them that, come upon this town, they go, welcome to late stage capitalism. Like, buzzword alert. There's also a reference to cancel culture. And I should note that this film is set outside of Austin. And of course, Joe Rogan has come under fire of late for having the nerve to host someone with heterodox opinions on the vaccine, on the COVID-19 vaccine. But that's neither here nor there. It's funny. It's as if this movie read some sort of Cole's Notes study guide of the 1974 Texas Chainsaw and tried to just insert a bunch of slapdash subtext into it where it doesn't even belong. I mean, these teens are supposedly from Austin, and that presents an interesting dynamic, because listeners may not know, but there's been a massive influx to the state of Texas from California. People are moving out of California and moving to Texas, not just Joe Rogan, but a bunch of celebrities and whatnot, and they are drawn to the Silicon Valley light, I guess you could say, that is Austin, Texas. It's a kind of a bro town, and it takes a lot of has a lot of investors going over there, and it's a bit of a boom town right now. There's a bit of a gold rush, and lots of people are moving to Austin. And it's pretty funny. If you're a fan of the comedian Tim Dillon, he's got a pretty good rant about Austin, Texas, and its bro culture and its lack of good restaurants. I highly recommend people check it out. Tim Dillon's kind of a funny podcaster. It's just funny that they could have had a dynamic whereby you could pit like the modern Texas versus the perceptions of the old Texas. And it seems like this film's foot is firmly in the latter camp. And when you think about it, you take a city like San Antonio, it's, I think, half Hispanic. That's a major city, the third largest in the state. Houston and Dallas have huge Hispanic populations. And sure, you could go to the hillbilly sticks and find some toothless redneck in there, but it's just not the same environment that we're coming to, and it's not the same set of expectations that comes with it when you have Texas. So they had so much they could have done with this, although what they did was just like the Wrong Turn reboot. They just took a black guy, shoved him in this movie. Why? I don't know. They were just hoping for some sort of extra layer of beyond the patina of whatever kind of meaning they're trying to stretch out. It just doesn't make any sense. It's funny. I was thinking about the first Night of the Living Dead. He got to George A. Romero with just incredibly subversive casting of Dwayne Jones in the lead role, an African American, and they don't have Dwayne Jones saying, "Oh, I'm, you know, doing Black Power salutes or wearing Angela Davis a shirt or being some sort of rebellious, Black Power, proponent." He's just people watching it at the time and first time watchers now will notice the dynamic between him and the others when they realize he's the most competent leader among them and they have to defer to him, and some of them are reticent to do so. You see the racial dynamics at play without being beaten over the head with a ball-peen hammer like this movie does with it. I mean, okay, we get it. They're scrolling through, yes, hands up, don't shoot, yes, all the memes and all the stupid crap. Okay, and now they've gotten to deal with the Confederate flag issue. I mean, this is so lazy, so hackneyed, so rushed, so boring, so tedious. And not only do you not have a premise that's viable as anything that anyone with a third of gray matter could even buy into, you have a setting that's so cheap and so Eastern European, you'd think Steven Seagal might have location scouted there. This is like, it's outside of what, Sofia, Bulgaria, or I don't even know. I think that's where they filmed it. It could have been, God knows, Romania or something. But this is not a movie that looks like Texas. And damn, I was thinking back to the Chainsaw Confidential book by Gunnar Hansen. And in that book, he details the struggles that Tobe Hooper faced when filming the first Texas Chainsaw Massacre, most notably being just the blazing hot sun and just the sweatiness and the how bloody hot that movie is. It really takes you into it. You have the Leatherface character noticeably sweating, all the characters sweating. The whole thing was fraught with difficulties relating to the heat, and you could see it on the characters' faces. This lent itself to a sense of place that's firmly established in the Tobe Hooper movie that is not established here, for God's sake. There's no sense of place here. And speaking of place, tonally, this one is all over the map. There is supposed to be, and I'm going to spoil the shit out of it here because this is a steaming heap of dung anyway. So, but there's an infamous scene. I don't know if it's been in the some of the trailers or whether it's been spoiled elsewhere. But there's a scene where Leatherface gets on the party bus and is about to lay waste to all these hapless pseudo investors, and they all pull out. I mean, all. They all pull out their phones, and the one guy says, "You're about to be canceled, dude," or some. I mean, it's like an insult to the political left as much as this movie is an insult to the political right. And you can almost say that regardless of where you are in the political spectrum, this one will insult your intelligence in some respect. So kudos to that. But it would have been funny if you had maybe one character do that, but all of them do it in unison, and it just cheapened the whole proceedings. It's supposed to be a horror film, may I remind you. So if you want to have your subtext, you want to have your cake and eat it too, you need to be reminded of, all filmmakers, all film directors, that what comes first in a horror film is horror. And that's undergirded by and supported by a substrata of atmosphere. You need a decent atmosphere. Hell, half this movie takes place in the rain. Is that what you think of when you think of Texas? A bloody rainstorm, like it's like some subtropical like tourist destination and you're in the rainy season of Costa Rica or something? No, you want Texas to be dry. You want it to be where the oil fields are. You want it to be desolate. You want to have cacti. You want snakes. You want Texas, damn it. Jeez Louise, this thing Europe isn't Texas. It can't substitute for that kind of look and feel. I mean, this, I just can't believe why you would have this movie be in the rain. Now, I guess we could segue into what we've learned here. I feel like I've been crapping enough on this, but Sarah Yarkin, she was in Happy Death Day to You, which was a kind of an underrated series. And one and two were actually pretty good. She acquits herself actually very well in this movie. Some people have lambasted her and ripped her, but I think if there's one reliable component to this turd, it would be her investment in the character, and I couldn't believe it. It's like she's been parachuted in from a completely different movie altogether, one that's far better than this. But she gives it her all in a very plucky performance as one of the interceders and one of the interlopers who comes in along with her sister to be a, I guess, one of these low-level investor types. I think she wants to open a cake shop or, you know, one of these de facto hipster businesses, right? And that brings me to another point here. Her sister, I forget the actress who plays her, but there's this shoehorned in, crowbarred in exercise in gun control that's just railroaded in here and has no purpose being here whatsoever, other than you are exposed to this woman's scar on her chest because, and get this, folks, she was a victim of a school shooting a la Columbine. This seems like an incredible way to get us invested in a character and humanize her more. Instead of just showing a bullet hole, why not show the school shooting she was involved in? They do it in flashbacks, and they do it so unceremoniously and so unadroitly that it is rendered completely inert and completely useless. But this woman went through this ordeal, and this is par for the course in a lot of horror films, where you have to overcome your fear, and the fear is introduced at the outset, and then you overcome that fear in order to get the better of your antagonist. And I'm thinking of the film Crawl. Just off the top of my head as an example, you have someone who was a competitive swimmer at one point, and then she's called upon to, and then she was browbeaten out of the sport by her domineering father, who's trying to live his athletic dreams through her, but she overcomes, powers through, and even though she's not swam in the interceding decade or whatever it was, it's been a while since I've seen that one, but In Crawl, she manages to use her swimming ability to escape the predatory beast in that film. And well, speaking of beasts here, I mean, the original Leatherface, let's be honest, here had a bestial quality, but like Boris Karloff in the James Whale Frankenstein movies, Bride of Frankenstein and whatnot, there is a certain pathos that came with the character. In the case of Karloff, he had it in his eyes, and there's a scene in the 1931 film, I believe, when he takes a girl and throws her into the lake because he thinks, like lilies, that the girl will float along the surface and no harm will come of her. So in the original, I believe they had to original iteration, they wanted to have Karloff really fling this girl in rather viciously to her, well, drown to her death, right? Spoiler alert for a 90-year-old movie, but what Karloff wanted to do was more gently put her in, and so he was having difficulty, and this speaks to his character as well, as a human being, as a real good mensch himself, but he didn't want audiences to be too overcome with the monster being too monstrous. So I think that Gunnar Hansen had that a little bit in his performance as well. And one of the key things missing from this incarnation of Leatherface as well is the family dynamic, because at its heart, Texas Chainsaw is about family. And when you have the deceased patriarch swinging the hammer, that's such an iconic scene. Well, he's not swinging it, of course, it's being swung for him, and that was such a mindfuck in that film, to have you realize that this desiccated guy is actually dead, and he's still the family patriarch and still sitting at the dinner table, or the main table, the dining table. That was such a staple of that film. And while we're at it here, similarly to Halloween, they've retconned all the interceding movies, and which is, you know, not necessarily the world's worst thing, given how tawdry and schlocky a lot of these TCM movies are. But they follow the template, the boilerplate of Halloween, in that they have a lone survivor from the first film, 40 years hence, who's still so overcome by what happened that fateful night that she can't help but devote her entire life. Like, this is a Laurie Strode, essentially, redux, brought to the fore just to be the same damn character. Although, unlike the Strode character, in whom something at least was invested, because you saw a little bit of her life and how she'd been a little shattered and suffering from PTSD and having some issues with her family dynamic. That's something they tried to build in the 2018 movie with Jamie Lee Curtis. And to Curtis's credit, she's such a good actress that she was able to bring that to the forefront. For Sally Hardesty here, the Marilyn Burns character from the first one, obviously Burns left us in 2015, I believe, but there's no backstory there. All she is a cowboy with a shotgun. I've been waiting 30, 40 years to get him. And it's just a little sliver of what Halloween brought to us. David Gordon Green with that conceit handled very, very clumsily here. Very poorly as well. So you're left with these 20-year-olds who basically act like they're 16, essentially. And they're left to fight off this Leatherface, and he is just laying waste to them. And much is said about all the gore in this one, which is funny too, that you feel like you have to, both in the case of this and Halloween, infuse a movie with a surfeit of gore, given that the originals were so deft and so iconic that they didn't even need gore, but only hinted at it and provided scares without it, that it's a testament to how low things have gotten, that when these things are reimagined, they have to be just so chock-a-block full of gore. And there are some pretty good kills. One of the characters gets a hammer to the skull and is just beaten into a pulp. And that's pretty incredibly rendered, if it weren't for the fact that the cliche among cliches, we have the victim hiding under the bed watching this happen. I'm so tired of characters hiding under the bed. It's been done. Let's move on from that. Let's leave it. Let's leave the footsteps coming up the stairs and only see the boots under the bed. I'm damn sick of that conceit. That's for damn sure. Good Lord. I don't even know if I'm forgetting anything. There was this Harlow, Texas. There's an abandoned movie theater. I don't know if this is supposed to be some meta reference to the state of cinema, but if it is, it's been left in complete disarray because this cinema is degraded to the point where it could probably screen this movie. That's how bad things are. But it's got some sort of flooding in it, and one of the characters falls into it. I don't know if anyone associates movie theaters with basement flooding that's 5 foot deep. It's almost like a Dario Argento's Inferno or something. That's how much water is in this thing, or the aforementioned Crawl. It makes no sense whatsoever. The town looks like a bad Twilight Zone episode. Fake as ersatz, as fugazi, as completely fake as hell, rendered completely in just uselessly. The only time this movie comes alive is again with Yarkin giving it her all in the lead, trying to make something of this hash, and a few scenes where there's some pretty nice sunflowers that are rendered quite nicely in an almost European art house kind of style. And there's a few stylistic departures that are kind of neat, and there's a few decent shots, but ultimately there's really nothing here. It's empty, it's devoid of any content, it's poorly conceived, poorly constructed from top to finish, and strangely, it's 80 minutes. And it feels like 2.5 hours. This feels like a Ken Burns documentary. This is how long this fucker is, pacing-wise. And one of the things that drew me to it, because I knew right off the bat this would be a steaming heap of dung when I saw the trailer and how bad the trailer was and just how god-awful the trailer was. But my God, is this a long-feeling movie. This one is. It's exhausting. It feels like a red-eye flight. It is a bad movie. It stinks on all counts. There's a subplot with one of the characters being evicted from this town, which I don't know. How is that possible? They're auctioning the town off. How is this person still living there? How are you supposed to feel sympathy for someone when the town is being auctioned off? It's not like they're chaining themselves to the sign, welcome to Harlow, and saying, you know, don't demolish it, and they're some sort of de facto activist. No, they're living there in some sort of God knows what, who came up with this idea. I don't know. I have no clue what they were thinking. I don't know what anyone was thinking. There's a big bus massacre in which 20 of these unnamed investors who get massacred, and there's no emotional payoff because none of these people say anything the whole movie. So who am I to give two fucks about someone in whom we've invested nothing? They've said nothing. They've given you nothing, no reason to invest in them. They're useless ciphers and pointless characters just to ratchet up the body count. And characters, the ones who even have any semblance of backstory, are there merely to be mouthpieces for the script writer. That's it. So they can insert all their like right-wing and left-wing BS into this movie at the expense of telling an actual story and at the expense of furthering Hooper's vision in the iconic 1974 film. So, my God, steer well clear of this place. Take an interstate, go to Louisiana, go to Arizona, just bypass this entirely. This is rotten to the core. I mean, for everything down from the title to the setting to much of the acting, I'll give it this much. Leatherface is pretty creepy at times, and there's one or two scenes, particularly when he busts through a van, that brings the horror bona fides, but that these are few and far between. There's maybe two or three solid scenes in the whole film. The rest is just a complete hackneyed mess from start to finish. One of the worst reboots I've ever seen. It makes Prom Night look like Roman Polanski's Finest. It is just horrendous. It makes the Carrie reboot look like, you know, David Cronenberg's best work. It is off the charts. This is a stinker of epic proportions. This should be buried. This should be forgotten. This should be stuffed into a time capsule. It should be incinerated. Should be fired into space. This thing stinks royally. And it's an insult because this is the first horror film I ever saw. 1974 Texas Chainsaw has such a tightly atmospheric feel, and you have the John Larroquette voiceover, you have the crawler, which led me to believe, because I was just 11 or 12, that this was a true story, and it had a kind of guerrilla feel that lent you to believe that you were actually part of the proceedings. It took you into a different world. That's what horror is supposed to do. It's not supposed to keep you in a certain world, or is it supposed to be escapism at its finest, at its peak, at its apex, at its apotheosis. This is not. This is cheap. This is slapdash filmmaking. This is cash-in filmmaking. It's cynical garbage. This is direct that you should avoid at all costs. I'm going to give this 1 star, and that 3/4 of that one is thanks to Yarkin, who gives it her all and does her best. There's some good effects. Yes, but my God, I don't know how much more damage they can inflict on this poor property. Leave it alone. Leave things best alone. We can't take it anymore. We give up. No mas. We're done. Anyway, hope you enjoyed this episode of the podcast. A little bit of a downer on this one. Anyway, continue to listen to new episodes uploaded for your listening pleasure every Friday. Guaranteed. And be sure to check out our books, Death by Umbrella, The 100 Weirdest Horror Movie Weapons with Foreword, Lloyd Kaufman, and of course, Mine's Bigger Than Yours, The 100 Wackiest Action Movies. You will like that one if you're a genre film fan. Action movies, 80s lunkhead action movies. Foreword, Brian Trenchard Smith, the Ausploitation legend. And we'll talk to you soon. Take care. Thank you.